WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Larry McMurtry, best known for his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel Lonesome Dove and other books about the American West, died last week at the age of 84. He wrote more than 30 novels and screenplays, as well as books of essays, memoir, and history. His fiction helped shape the way Americans perceived the Western frontier. McMurtry was raised on a Texas ranch, and his uncles had been cowboys, but he was not one to mythologize the West. He wrote Lonesome Dove, about a cattle drive near the end of the 1800s, as an anti-Western, and the miniseries adapted from it became a huge hit. McMurtry was also the author of The Last Picture Show and Terms of Endearment, which were both adapted into films, and Horsemen Pass By, which was the basis of the film Hud. McMurtry also became an antiquarian bookseller and collector, inspired in part by his love of reading, which he said helped him envision life beyond the ranch. Before we hear Terry's interview with McMurtry, let's listen to a clip from the TV adaptation of Lonesome Dove. At the heart of the story is the relationship between Augustus McCrae, played by Robert Duvall, and Captain Woodrow Call, played by Tommy Lee Jones. Both are former Texas Rangers. Duvall's character loves life and talks about his feelings. Jones generally doesn't. In this scene, Jones has come upon Duvall, who's weeping over a lost love. The conversation turns to prostitutes, and one Captain Call has apparently fathered a son with.
I don't know why you sit down on a whore's, Woodrow. You've had yours as I recall.
Yeah, and that was the worst mistake I ever made.
It ain't a mistake to have been a human being once in your life, Woodrow. Poor little old Maggie left you a fine son before she quit this world.
You don't know that. That boy could be yours or Jake's or some damn gambler.
Yeah, but he ain't. He's yours. Now, anybody with a good eye can see it. Besides, Maggie told me. We were good friends.
I don't know about friends. I'm sure you was a good customer, though.
Well, the two can't overlap, you know.
You're the one that didn't know about overlapping with whores, I reckon.
You know what hurt her most? You wouldn't call her by name. You never would say Maggie. That's what hurt her most.
I don't know what it amounted to if I had.
It would have made her happy.
What are you talking about? She's a whore.
Well, whores got hearts, Woodrow, and Maggie's was the most tender I ever saw.
Well, why didn't you marry her then?
She didn't love me. She loved you. You should have seen how she sat in that saloon every day watching the door after you quit coming around.
I reckon the man has got more to do than to sit in a saloon with a whore.
Like what? Go down the river every night and clean his gun? Maggie needed you. You let her down. You know it too, don't you?
No, I don't know anything of the dang kind.
And that's why you won't claim that boy as your own, because he's a reminder, see? A living reminder that you failed somebody. And you ain't never going to be up to admitting that. Now are you?
Like I said, Maggie was just a whore.
Well, I got Woodrow. At least you finally called her by name. I guess that shows some improvement now, don't it?
Terry spoke with Larry McMurtry in 1995.
Of course, I come from ranching stock. I had nine uncles who were cattlemen. My father was a cattleman. Some of my uncles were old enough to participate a little bit in the last years of the trail driving era, which only lasted one generation. The reason there were trail drives is because there were no railroads to transport the cattle to market. As soon as there were railroads, it became very inefficient to drive cattle hundreds and thousands of miles, and of course they stopped. But the myth of the cowboy, as we have it today, came out of that roughly 20-year period, 20, 25 years, after the Civil War, in which the range cattle industry suddenly sort of flowered, kind of like the oil industry did a bit later, in which it was necessary to get all the cattle in South Texas, millions of them, north to the markets. And it's very different from ranch life, which is not particularly romantic and not particularly cinematic. So most of the myth of the cowboy came out of that one generation of trail drivers, and it was perfectly possible, since cowboys were often very young, 13, 14, 15 years old. My uncles all left home before they were 14 and became cattlemen. Perfectly possible for one boy to have gone up the trail with the first herds in, say, the mid-60s, right after the Civil War, and the last herds in the mid-80s or a little bit later. So it was all over in a very brief period of time. And the fact that it lasted such a short while lent a certain romance and a certain poignancy to it.
So you grew up on a cattle ranch?
Yeah, on a small ranch in central, north central Texas, just below the Red River, near a town called Wichita Falls, about 100 miles west of Dallas, Fort Worth, northwest.
Did your father expect you to keep on the ranch? And
I think he might have liked it. It was evident pretty early that this was not going to be my skill. It was also, my father was, not dumb, and he saw that the cattle business had already ceased to be a viable family business unless you own immense, immense amounts of land, which we didn't. And even my uncles, who left home early and got to the Panhandle when it was open range and ended up with very substantial amounts of land, couldn't survive as ranchers. Ranching is an industry almost entirely supported by oil or by other money. You know, the ranchers now are doctors and lawyers and architects and people who have gotten rich in other professions. It's my father foresaw this as early as I can remember, which is by the mid-40s. He saw that the amount of land that we had he made a decent living throughout his life. He was very, very skilled, but he was still in debt for 55 years, and he had four children. There's no way that if you divide that ranch by four that it can make a living for anybody. It wouldn't make a living for anybody even if it wasn't divided by four, and that was foreseen by my father very early on.
What was the life that you imagined you wanted when you were growing up in Texas, realizing that you wanted to get off the cattle ranch and you wanted to get out of the small town?
Well, I wanted a life in literature, essentially, and I realized that quite young. I didn't imagine that I would become a writer, but I knew that I could become a reader. And so reading has always drawn me from the age of five or six. It drew me out of the small town. It drew me to Houston, to Rice University. And it was sort of the strongest motivating factor for most of my youth. And as it turned out, like many readers, I began to try it for myself to see if I could do this thing that had given me so much pleasure. And I was lucky and successful. But it was reading that that took me off the range.
Were there bookstores around when you were growing up?
No, I had almost no books until I got to Rice. I did have a cousin who, as he was going off to war in 1941, I was like five at the time, stopped by the ranch house on his way to what turned out to be the Pacific Theater and left me some books, 19 books, in fact, a tiny, just a bunch of sort of the normal boys' books of the time. And that was my library for quite a spell. There were some books in the high school library in Archer City, but not a whole lot. And I didn't really have adequate literary resources until I was a college student. Perhaps that's one reason I'm a rare bookseller as well as an author.
When you started writing books about the Old West, was your idea to further the myth, to debunk the myth of the West, or revise the myths of the West?
You know, I didn't start really writing books about the Old West. I think Lonesome Dove was my 10th novel. Most of my books were set in the contemporary West and still are. And in fact, in my fiction, I think I've written 19 novels, and the one with my collaborator, Diana Osana. And of those 19, only about four of them deal with the Old West. Mostly I've dealt with contemporary Western life, a la Terms of Endearment, a la The Last Picture Show, or the book called Horseman Passed By that became the movie HUD. I thought that the Western myth, or the myth of the cowboy, is very powerful. I thought that Lonesome Dove was, in a way, a critique of it, because I grew up with cowboys. I respect them up to a point, but I'm not crazy about them, and I know, I think, something of their limitations, having grown up with them. So I didn't set out to write a book which glorified the myth of the West. I didn't particularly set out to write a book that debunked it either. You know, I was telling a story of three men who had been friends for a long time, who who got caught up in an adventure, and the book was a description of that adventure and its consequences.
Give us an example of something in the story that you see as a critique of the myth of the West.
Well, for example, the scathing denunciation that Clara Allen makes of Captain Call at when he arrives at her house with Gus's body, when she tells him why she didn't marry Gus, although he was her great love, because she didn't feel that she could hold Gus, that she didn't feel that there was any room for a woman in a domestic relationship in Gus and Call's life. It's not that she felt that they hated women, it's just that they simply didn't give them their due. I think that women had a terrible time in the early West. Many of them went berserk. And I think that it was a masculine culture, maybe of necessity, but it was a masculine culture and to some extent crude, to some extent fascistic, certainly not welcoming to women.
Well, one of the main characters in your series, Lorena, is, she's a prostitute during some
she's
of the
Yeah,
story.
She's a prostitute and she's a whore in Lonesome Dove. And
she's kind of forced into it, really. I mean,
there's a character, strangely enough, in Dead Man's Walk, the book that's being filmed now, when they're debating, two men are talking about a woman named Matilda Jane Roberts, who's a whore. And one of the characters remarks on her origin. She came into the West when she was 14, and both her parents died trying to get from St. Louis to Santa Fe or somewhere along the trail. And she became a whore to survive. And one of the characters says there wasn't no room for church-going women in the West in those days, just room for whores, and a lot of them didn't survive. And that's true enough. You know, my grandmother was a pioneer woman, and the West was sort of unsettleable until after around 1875, simply because the Indian Wars were still raging intensely, and my own grandparents paused in their Western migration at a safe line in Northwest Texas. And lived there for 10 years. They didn't go any farther west because they wouldn't have survived the Comanches, very likely, if they had. And then when the Comanches were finally subdued, more or less, in 1874, when their horse herd was destroyed, my grandparents went on to the place where they raised their family and where, in fact, I have the ranch house now, about 100 miles farther west into the Comancheria after it became safe.
Did your grandmother give you insights about what it was like to be a woman in the early days of Western settlements?
My grandmother, I don't remember my grandmother ever even speaking to me, although I lived with her. She lived in our house until she died, and I was a boy of 10 when she died. She had raised 12 children, lost one on a frontier. She was completely tired of children. She probably had 100 grandchildren by then, or between 50 and 100. She was used it up. I don't recall a single thing that my grandmother ever said to me.
Were you hurt?
Sure. No, I wasn't. I mean, it's only in the last few years that I've been looking back on that. Both my grandparents, and I mean, all four of my grandparents lived and died in the house that I was growing up in, and I had some relations with one grandfather. One of my grandmothers was substantially broken by the time I came into this world. And the other one wasn't broken, but she just sort of was through with children. I wasn't hurt at the time. I only reflect on it on that in the last few years that I really can't remember my McMurtry grandmother ever speaking a word to me. She must have, but I think it was more like get out of the way or shut the door or something like that. Certainly no stories ever came from her.
Larry McMurtry speaking with Terry Gross in 1995. He wrote the novels Lonesome Dove, The Last Picture Show, and Terms of Endearment, and many other books. He died last week at the age of 85. We'll hear more of their interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with writer Larry McMurtry. His novel, The Last Picture Show, was adapted into a film in 1971, directed by Peter Bogdanovich. It stars Jeff Bridges, Timothy Bottoms, and Sybil Shepherd in a coming-of-age story set in a small Texas town. Let's hear a scene. Actor Ben Johnson won an Academy Award for his performance in the film as Sam the Lion, the owner of the town cafe, movie theater, and pool hall. Here he is with a couple of boys at the local fishing hole.
I never liked to clean fish or eat them either. Spend half your time picking out bones. Yeah, I just come out here to get a little scenery. Too pretty a day to spend in town. You wouldn't believe how this country's changed. First time I seen it, there wasn't a mesquite tree on it. Or a prickly pear neither. I used to own this land, you know. First time I watered a horse at this tank was more than 40 years ago. I reckon the reason why I always drag you out here is probably I'm just as sentimental as the next fella when it comes to old times. Old times. I brought a young lady swimming out here once. More than 20 years ago. It was after my wife had lost her mind. My boys was dead. Me and this young lady was pretty wild, I guess. In pretty deep. We used to come out here horseback and go swimming without no bathing suits. One day she wanted to swim the horses across this tank. Kind of a crazy thing to do, but we'd done it anyway. She bet me a silver dollar she could beat me across. She did. This old horse I was riding didn't want to take the water. But she was always looking for something to do like that. Something wild. I bet she still got that silver dollar.
Whatever happened to her?
Oh, she growed up. She was just a girl then, really.
Did the place in Texas that you grew up in resemble the small town that you wrote about in the last picture show?
Well, it was. That's where the last picture show was filmed. I have the unusual circumstance of having seen one of my stories filmed in the place where it would have happened. The last picture show and Texasville were both filmed in the small town of Archer City, Texas, which is where I grew up. The town is now sort of slightly confused. It's been so much fiction touched on it. It doesn't really know whether it's fact or fiction. And sometimes when I go home, I feel like I'm living in my own theme park. You know, they have restaurants called Texasville, and it's rather odd. I've inundated that little town with fiction, and, you know, most people think that they must be some character in one of the books. They're not quite sure which, and, yeah, it's unusual.
That's funny, because I think the reaction to The Last Picture Show was pretty bad when it was first published, the reaction in your town, because of the sexuality in the book.
That's a little overblown,
actually.
That's because journalists have to have something to write about, and the Baptist minister, indeed, was offended by the movie and one or two other people in town, but in fact, a lot of people in the town worked on the movie and saw what was happening. A lot of, even then, in 1971, it brought about $1 million into the town in a time like that. That county, which I suppose was cattle country when my grandparents stopped there in 1880, was definitely the oil patch by then, and it depends upon the fluctuations in oil prices, not cattle prices. And the cattle prices haven't amounted to anything for hardly in my lifetime, and I'm 60 years old. It's the oil patch, and when the oil business is up, it flourishes a little bit. But I've been buying building after building and putting, books in them. The townspeople, I think, are slightly alarmed, but in fact, nobody but me wants those buildings. And, you know, the town is down to a hardware store and a drug store. Hmm. Doesn't have a hospital anymore. And it has a couple of filling stations, a hardware store and a drug store, and an abstract company and a bank, and that's about it. And if there's any other services in Archer City, they're oil-related services, not cattle.
You know, I was thinking maybe we'd end the interview with a song by your son James, who's a singer-songwriter. Do you see his songs connected to your writing in any way?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think James is remarkable in that he's found a way to work that's not my way. That is, he's not a novelist. He's really more of a musician. But I think that the songs reflect a later stage of the same phenomenon. You know, the post, certainly the post-rural West, even the post-small-town West, in a way. I think a lot of them are very good songs.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a very good talk.
Larry McMurtry speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1995. He died last week at the age of 85. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.